Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome, and thank you for joining me today for a conversation with Carrie J. Preston about her recent book, Learning to Kneel, No Modernism and Journeys in Teaching. This is a Columbia University Press book that came out in 2016. It's a super exciting book, and in part that has to do with not just the story it's telling, but also the way it tells that story. So integral to the research and the work that Carrie did, as she'll talk about in a few moments, was her own experience taking lessons in no chant, taking lessons in no dance, in drumming, writing plays based on these models, teaching, producing, choreographing dances with no related gestures, and you'll hear us talking about that in a moment, and that really threads through the entirety of the book. And it feels organic also to the arguments that the book is making. So one of the things you'll hear us talk about is the centrality throughout the book of the insight that no, as a form of drama, is centrally concerned with pedagogy, teaching. And so what we get in a narrative that very explicitly brings in Carrie's own experience as a teacher and student and reflections on that kind of relationship, what we get is not just a series of breaths of fresh air in the narrative that open the book out in ways that are really exciting, but we also get a multi-layered reflection on the connection between no and pedagogy, between performance and pedagogy, that it really fingers through every single part of the work that the book is doing. It's really interesting, it's really important, and it's really effective, I think. So there's a special chapter, you'll hear us talking about this in the moments to come, that is a pedagogical intermission in which Carrie gives us a lesson plan and relates her own experiences in a graduate seminar in ways that are really exciting. And you'll also hear us talking about a website that exists as a companion to the book where listeners or readers can look to find other kinds of pedagogical materials and lesson plans and exercises that might be useful in teaching with the book or teaching with some of these ideas. So I will let you get to it. It's a fairly extensive interview, but I'll also say that one thing that you'll hear coming up, and one for me particularly surprising part of this interview and of the experience of reading the book, is how much it feels so much of the moment right now, even though this came out last year, right? It's extraordinarily timely, and you'll hear us talking about themes such as fascism, nationalism, and all kinds of related issues that if anybody is awake and alive and reading the news here in early 2017 and has any interest in what's going on globally, not just in the U.S., there will be much of interest here to think with in ways that might surprise you given the thematic or kind of topical focus of the book. Okay, so this is to say it's fascinating. It's really elegantly and eloquently written and produced. It's super timely, and it's also really beautiful. And so with that, thank you for listening. I hope you get the chance to get your hands on the book, to explore the website. And I hope you enjoy the interview to come. I'm here today to talk with Carrie J. Preston about her new book, Learning to Kneel. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Carrie, and thank you, first of all, for writing such an exciting book. And I think we'll talk in the next hour about what is so exciting about this book, but also for making time to talk with me about it today. Welcome to the podcast, and it's great to have you here.
Thanks so much, and thanks for the invitation.
Of course. So let's start with the traditional question for the channel. How did you come to work on the study of modernism and performance? Because this isn't your first book, right? You've got a pretty long scholarly career before this. And so how did you come to work in this field?
So I really came to learning to kneel through the figure of Ito Michio. When I was writing my first book, Modernism's Mythic Pose, I was doing a lot of research in the Isadora Duncan Dance Archives at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. And I came across a review of a Japanese dancer, Ito Michio, a man who was performing some of Isadora Duncan's iconic solos, like Mother and Lullaby. And I was really curious about how he learned this choreography. And at some point, I recalled that a Japanese dancer had worked with W.B. Yeats and Ezra Pound on some dance plays that had interested me in graduate school. Lo and behold, it was in fact Ito Michio who had worked with Yeats and Pound and others in London in 1916. And as I began to track Ito's career as a dancer, I realized that there was a whole story about his collaboration and then how the ancient Japanese theater form known as no, that's N-O-H. But of course, there are plenty of jokes about not knowing no, nobody knows no theater. All of those kinds of jokes are out there. So no influenced modernism quite profoundly. And it was a story that really hadn't been told. So my focus shifted from an interest in Ito's life and collaborations to tracking how No shaped modernist theater, performance, dance, and ultimately poetics entered into the story as well.
So the book tells the story, and this is in the words of the book, of the global circulation of No-inspired performances and the ways they affected the arts of the 20th century, mainly drama, poetry, modern dance, film, and popular entertainment. And this is from the book itself. Now, the book emphasizes in a lot of ways the physicality of no lessons, the challenge of being still, the pain of kneeling in a particular position. You explain early on in the book, in the introduction, in no, pedagogy and performance are deeply intertwined. Now, one of the really fascinating things about the book is that the story of your own lessons in no chants, dance, and drumming, and your experience writing plays based on no models, choreographing dances with no related gestures, is woven throughout the book as one of the main kind of integral threads, really throughout the chapters. I really, really loved that. And I'd like to, I'd like if you could talk a little bit about that decision in terms of how you envisioned and then created the book as an object.
I had not planned for that to be part of the story, although it was so much fun to incorporate that into the book. Again, for my first book, I studied Isadora Duncan's technique and choreography, and it certainly shaped the way I could write about Duncan as a dancer, and shaped the way I could write about movement from the perspective of someone who had actually learned the technique and struggled to learn the dances. So that has become part of my methodology when writing about performance. As I began to do the first rounds of research, the sort of literary review part of research, I was really dissatisfied with how many people, how many critics said, I really don't know anything about the No Theater, but Yates and Pound knew even less and sort of left it at that. And I thought that was kind of a cop-out, actually, for a critic and a scholar. And I decided that I wanted to learn as much as possible about the No Theater. And it quickly became clear to me that knowing No, learning No, involved taking lessons. Pedagogy, in the part that you quoted earlier, pedagogy is so crucial to this theater form. And that's really different from any kind of experience I've had learning an art form. The teacher is celebrated. Very frequently, the teacher is there in the theater, often kneeling as one of the koken at the back of the stage. If the performer makes a mistake, the teacher might step up and step in and correct or start chanting. I've seen this happen in a professional play. A teacher starts chanting from the back of the stage and correcting the performer who has messed up the chant or gone to a different part in the play, typically. So this is really different from, taking piano lessons and going out and performing the piece you've learned, and the teacher might be watching but would very rarely step in. Or in Western theater, if you make a mistake, you're supposed to hide it as much as possible, and the show must go on inevitably. So this is a very different relation to pedagogy, to the relationship between teachers and students, than in any theater form that I had learned previously. I was so fascinated by my experience living in Tokyo and taking lessons that as I began to draft the chapters, I allowed myself to include part of that story briefly in the introduction, and thought that then I had to go back and write a kind of standard critical narrative. Like, I got the story out of the way, and then I would focus on the figures that I was writing about and the pieces that I was discussing. But I got one really excellent review back when the press sent out the first few chapters for review. One of the reviewers said, "This story is fascinating. That voice was the voice that I wanted to hear for the rest of the book. And I hope that the writer can continue to thread that part of the story, the part of taking lessons and the personal voice through the rest of the book." And my editor, who's fantastic, Philip Leventhal at Columbia University Press, encouraged me to pursue that strategy and helped me actually learn to write that way. And it made all of the difference. This was such a fun book to write, and I was able to come to some understanding of why No had become so important in my own life, and why I felt like there was a different way to talk about the modernist artist's interest in No, by thinking about how they in certain ways were taking lessons, how they were learning, both from figures who knew about No, learning in collaborative groups, trying to do research, becoming students of No in a way, that allowed me to tell the story quite differently from the way cultural appropriation kept popping up as the typical explanation for this material or the typical framework that surrounded this material. It allowed me to have, in some ways, a more positive and optimistic approach to what is surely a cultural appropriation, but is also much more than that.
And in fact, in the introduction, you talk about the ways that your lessons actually, like, actively change the emphasis of your research, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Would you talk a little bit about that for us? Like, what were some of the main ways, and you do describe this in the book, but for listeners who haven't had a chance to read it, for you, what immediately comes to mind is aspects of your research that importantly changed as a result of this experience?
So when I had expected not to enjoy taking no lessons, I thought I was being very dutiful and I would learn a lot. But I had studied the pedagogical format of the no lesson. You kneel at the beginning of each lesson and bow. You spend most of the lesson on your knees. I thought that would be kind of humiliating, demeaning. There's a long history of misogyny in the no theater. So as a woman, I thought that would feel complicated. And as a Westerner, I knew that I needed to be very humble and thankful for the opportunity to learn in this way. But I went into my lessons with an assumption that I really wouldn't like it. And my experience couldn't have been more different. I loved taking lessons. I valued the relationship that I developed with my teacher. And it was an exceptional relationship, a relationship that I hadn't had very often with teachers in my life. I started to question basically all of my assumptions about what good teaching and what good learning meant. So I teach in an English department and in a women's gender and sexuality studies program. And I had assumed that the ideal of a democratic classroom was really the only kind of classroom that we should work for. We should seek casual relationships with our students, ones where we try to diminish the hierarchies that are part of teaching and learning, or the ways that the teacher is in a position of power and the students are less powerful or more submissive, in a more submissive role. I had assumed that good teaching would do all of that work. And this was such a different pedagogical experience. And yet I found it very, very powerful. It gave me access to the more ritualistic and even sacred aspects of the no theater. So the pedagogical format was very clearly tied to the goals of preserving an ancient repertory and of inculcating certain kinds of values in the student. I realized in this process that I needed to rethink some of my assumptions about good pedagogy and the ways that the attempt to foster a kind of casual democratic relationship with students was actually hiding the deep hierarchies that are ingrained in my own classrooms. Most obviously, I'm giving my students grades at the end of the semester and on every assignment. This isn't a casual relationship. It really is very much a professional relationship. I am not a friend to my students. They are paying a lot of money to go to an American university. So I realized that some of my attempts, and I think at the standard culture in an American classroom actually concealed the truth of the hierarchies and the power differentials that are present in the classroom, and that the very codified and hierarchical pedagogy in the no lesson was in some ways more honest. I couldn't immediately assume that my casual relationship with my students was preferable, or that it fostered good learning, that it was in fact a very much a cultural performance that was different from the cultural performance I was experiencing in my no lessons in Japan, but still very much a performance, not more authentic as we might tend to assume that being casual is more authentic in the U.S. So it really challenged the way I think about teaching and learning, and has impacted, in fact, the way that I conduct my classrooms now.
Great. And in fact, some of what you just mentioned, especially the significance of submission, right, and the theme of submission and humility, these keep coming up throughout the book. And this really nicely takes us, I think, to the first chapter, where you talk about the significance of humility and submission in performing a particular piece called the Feather Mantle, or Hagoromo. So this chapter looks at Ezra Pound and W.B. Yeats' collaboration with the person that you mentioned at the very beginning. This is Ito Michio. And central to this chapter is the translation and performance and impact of this particular piece, right? The Feather Mantle. Now, since this is a piece we're going to keep coming back to, as a way of maybe opening or starting to open this up for listeners, could you briefly describe the kind of what we need to know about this performance? What is the Feather Mantle, and what are some of the key things listeners need to know as we move forward in the book?
Sure. So this is probably the most popular no play, one of the most frequently done in Japan. And it's an incredibly beautiful one. It was also the favorite of Yeats and Pound as they began learning about no and producing translations of no plays together. I'm using translation very broadly there. Hagoromo, the feather mantle. The story is a fisherman on a beautiful spring day comes across a beautiful robe of feathers and wants to take it and keep it as a treasure for the realm. He is approached by a young maiden who says, "Give me back the robe." He says, "No, it's a treasure. I will keep it." She begs and tells him that she is, in fact, a moon maiden, a celestial being, and that without the robe, she won't be able to fly back to her home in the moon. He still refuses. And then he watches her start to die the death of a mortal. So she has flowers in her hair and they start to wilt. And he learns sympathy. And of course, this is a Buddhist lesson about not clinging to material objects like the robe that he holds in his hands, and also having sympathy for another creature. So he says that he'll give it back if she promises to teach him the dance that turns the moon, the dance that the moon maidens do in the palace of the moon. And she agrees. She says it would be a good thing to leave a dance for the sad mortal world below. But she needs her robe to perform the dance. He initially, the fisherman, is suspicious and says that he won't return it because she'll just fly off and not teach. And she becomes angry then and says, deceit is for mortals. We don't tell lies. The celestial beings don't tell lies. So he's ashamed again, gives her back her robe, and she performs the sacred dance. And this is one of the... It's a myth about how no came and no dancing came to the world. So that's one of the interesting features of the play, is that within the play that it tells the story of how no dancing was learned from a celestial being, one of the origin myths of no. And it's also a lovely play. The dancing is, I think, particularly gorgeous. The fan work in the choreography is very beautiful.
Now, the chapter considers how No influenced Ezra Pound's work, especially in terms of his imagism and his translation theory. And you talk about, among other things, the ways in which Pound is actually identifying with the figure of this fisherman that you just described. You also very briefly mentioned translation, right, as being a particularly interesting issue in this case. And this is one of the really interesting things for me that's happening in this chapter. So what the chapter is doing, among other things, is urging us to rethink an understanding of Pound's translation and his translation work as so-called like mistranslation or misrepresentation, necessarily considering these as flaws. And instead, what the chapter does is it uses the case of Pound to direct our attention to what you call the errors and creativity that are present in any translation. So here, translation becomes an opportunity for what you call creative misunderstanding. Carrie, could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. The typical critical account of Pound's No Translations has looked at all of the errors, and there are many errors. Pound was working from draft translations that were produced by the American Orientalist Ernest Fenollosa with the help of his student Hirata, and they were producing draft translations so that they could go see no plays and that Fenollosa could take lessons. These translations were sent to Pound by Fenollosa's widow, and he knew almost no Japanese when he started editing them and finishing them. So there are plenty of errors. One of the things that interests me, and one of the reasons I wanted to shift away from an account of the errors, which had actually, it's embarrassing in some ways. Critics have been embarrassed by this material for good reason. But if you get beyond the embarrassment and look at some of the decisions that Pound was making in the translations, you can actually see the development of his thought towards Imagism and the preparation for him to write his great opus, The Cantos. Mm-hmm. So he was making, and I look at this in Hagoromo, he was changing the language and the images of Hagoromo so that they would fit his theory of connected images, leading to a trope, a series of metaphors, continued metaphors, that would lead to some kind of new understanding. And he was trying to find a way to move from the very brief Imagist poems that he had written in A Station of the Metro being the most famous, and the brief Imagist poems that he had promoted, to think about how to write a long Imagist poem, one that could still abandon traditional poetic form and yet find some kind of structure through the repeated images and tropes that those images and metaphors would create. He believed that he found that technique in No. Largely, he translated that technique into the No plays. Mm-hmm. Meaning, in some ways, he mistranslated the No plays to provide the technique and structure for him. And then they, you know, so he was looking for something and he found what he was looking for partially by changing what was there in front of him. Mm-hmm. And as you suggested, the technique that he believed he learned in the No plays then became a technique that he took to the long poem that he would work on the rest of his life. And if you look at the cantos, and particularly the Pisan cantos, which is the section of the cantos that I focus on most in that chapter, No is present everywhere. And actually his collaboration on the No plays, the work he did with Ito and Yeats, is part of the story behind the Pisan cantos. Ito and Yeats both appear as characters in the Pisan cantos. So it's fascinating to me that Hagoromo both provided the structure, sort of the lesson that Pound needed to get started on his next big project. And then Hagoromo also appears as one of the lessons to be learned in the Pisan cantos. The lesson that the fisherman learns is a lesson that Pound believes he needs to learn in his account of that poem, which is a rather dramatic poem. It was written while Pound was stuck in a cage in Pisa and would soon stand trial for treason largely because of the radio broadcasts in support of Mussolini that he had sent out into the world during World War II. So Pound tells the story of his experience in the cage, which is where he was writing these poems, the poem sequence. And Hagoromo becomes a structuring device and the lesson that he needs to learn, the lesson of humility, largely.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, the chapter actually, towards the end, talks about the challenges of teaching Pound's cantos and the connection right, between the pleasures of submission and fascism. And you talk a little bit about why, despite or perhaps because of those challenges in part, it's actually important to teach difficult texts like this. And since this is a particularly timely moment, perhaps, these issues, right? Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Sure. That chapter ends with me, in fact, quoting one of my students, who felt like the Pisan cantos should not be taught because there are plenty of celebrations of Mussolini, echoes of fascism in the cantos. The whole story of Pound's incarceration is deeply troubling. He was largely in an experience of torture in this cage, exposed to the heat and the cold. And this was really troubling for students. I was shocked that my graduate students really hadn't known about Pound's fascism, about his experience in Pisa and then his subsequent, he was imprisoned in a hospital for mentally insane for a number of years after this. They found it all deeply troubling, and the particular quote that I begin that section of the chapter with is, this shouldn't be taught, or at least not to undergraduates. And it is really difficult to teach the Pisan cantos. And I think it's also really difficult to teach Ngo's influence on modernism, because we tend to be embarrassed. We want to, the great poets that we study, poets like Pound, who we believe really changed the face of poetry around the world, we want them to be good people. We want them to have our values. We want them to respect culture, to have somehow anticipated the versions of multiculturalism and diversity that we would like to promote. We tend to want to write about figures who will do that work for us, meaning that they will help us teach those values in our writing. And all of this material is really difficult to do that with. There was plenty of cultural misunderstanding and appropriation. And of course, there's the fascism. There's a piece of the book that discusses how the Ngo Theater was used to promote Japanese fascism and militarization. This is all stuff that we wish hadn't happened. And my position in the book is really that this is all the more reason that we need to teach this kind of material, because the world is so complicated. And if my graduate students were getting a version of modernism and a version of multiculturalism that was too rosy and too easy, then they were missing the real world. And that was deeply troubling. And you're right that this seems all the more relevant today as we face the question of how to support our students, how to teach in a time where our country seems to be slipping into more xenophobic, more misogynistic, more racist patterns, or those currents of our world seem to be emerging and being supported in the current U.S. administration. I think we need to bravely wade into this very, very difficult material with our students and in the relative safety of a college classroom. That's a place to begin conversations about difficult topics, to work towards a form of civic discourse that I feel like is being constantly attacked. I don't see civil discourse happening in our country in the way that I would like it to be happening. So yes, I feel like it's all the more imperative at this moment.
And speaking of nationalism, as a theme that also comes up, this actually really nicely brings us into the next chapter. So chapter 2 looks closely at Yeats's At the Hawk's Well and its global journey. And it considers, among other things, the role played by the play in Yeats's nationalism, and in particular in his particularly transnational nationalism, mm-hmm. and in his vision for the Irish theater. And it considers how Yeats adapted No for his own aesthetic and political purposes. Okay, so we could easily spend the rest of the time just talking about this chapter, right? It's fascinating. We can't do that, but what I'd like to do is just give listeners a sense of just some of what's animating this. This particular piece, At the Hawk's Well, is a piece that we're going to see recurring throughout the book. So I think in order to at least be able to begin to trace that, could you say a little bit about, for you, what are some of the most important elements of this Yeats production, At the Hawk's Well, that we need to know in order to be able to follow this then throughout the rest of the chapters of the book? For you, basically, like, what's most fascinating about how he's adapting and adopting conventions from No in producing this piece?
Sure. So the No play was heavily influenced by Hagoromo, the play that I described earlier that was fascinating to both Yeats and Pound. And in the play, the Irish mythic figure Cathaoirleán is going in search of a well of immortality. He's traveled by boat to a forbidding island, and comes across an old man and a young girl, hawk maiden, the guardian of a well. And the old man has been waiting by this well for the waters to come that will give him immortality for 50 years. Cathaoirleán says that he will wait, they'll share the water. The old man knows the patterns, sees this kind of glassy look in the guardian, the hawk maiden's eyes, and knows that the water is about to come. The old man has gone through this repeatedly. He falls asleep when the water comes. Cathaoirleán insists that if necessary, he will pierce his foot to stay awake and drink the immortal waters. In fact, what happens in the course of the play is the kind of typical shemai or dance scene in a No play. Both the old man and Cathaoirleán, the young man, become enchanted in different ways by the dance of the Hawk Maiden, which was played in the original 1916 production by Ito Michio. And the old man falls asleep. The young man, Cathaoirleán, becomes inculcated into the warrior's life and is actually going to initially do battle with the she, the Irish mythic figures of the hills. And that begins Cathaoirleán's journey as an Irish hero. Some of the fascinating elements of No, in addition to the dance that Yeats adopted, a chorus of simple instruments, drum beats that punctuate both the chant and the dialogue, seemingly improvisationally. That was a feature that Yeats adopted from the No Theater. Chant itself. So Yeats had long been interested in a form of poetic speech that felt like chant, that felt like speech, as he wrote, that it became inflamed and was just approaching song. And he believed that the No Theater provided that model of chant and also a set of movements that would do the kind of work his theater was meant to do. And in terms of nationalism, the work that he wanted his theater to do was to teach the Irish people to value their myths and legends again. And he knew that the No Theater took traditional Japanese myths and legends and reframed them in a theatrical mode. And so he hoped that using the No model, he could develop a national theater that would do that work, that creative work to help an audience reconnect with a culture that had been all but destroyed by British imperialism in Ireland.
Now, one of the things that the book does is it traces a series of adaptations and revivals of the play. And you end this chapter with an account, a really fascinating account, of your own experience with an adaptation and revival of Hawk's Well at the 2013 Mellon School of Theater and Performance Research at Harvard. This is another moment where, again, the weaving your own experience with the other elements of the narrative really makes the book come alive in a wonderful way. So would you want to speak a little bit to that here?
Sure. At the beginning of the process of kind of putting the structure of this book together, after I had gone and taken lessons in the No Theater, I had the incredible opportunity to teach an amazing group of students at the Mellon School in theater and performance research held at Harvard every summer. It was a group that combined graduate students and largely junior faculty, and the topic of the school was world theater. So I used a lot of my research in No in shaping the seminar that I was teaching. And I gave the students in my seminar materials I had gathered about at the Hawk's Well, images. I gave them some dance lessons, some No chant and movement lessons. I showed them a bit of the Ito technique that I had learned. And what was amazing is that they took that. Oh, I had the original score of the 1916 production, pieces of the original score that I gave them. They took these materials and decided to recreate at the Hawk's Well for the school and to perform it on the last day of the school. It was a remarkable production, one that I felt really captured the kind of experience that we might have had in 1916, because it was in a sort of drawing room environment for a coterie audience, we might say, an audience of people who were really interested in the theater, interested in world theater, global theater. And they made some fascinating choices. One of the choices that I talked about as being incredibly moving is that rather than having one dancer perform the dance of the guardian or the hawk maiden, they chose to have three dancers of very different dance backgrounds, all three different ethnicities and races, and they each pulled from their own background in dance, their own dance training, to create a choreography that was very specific to them. And somehow it felt to me like it really took those three dancers to kind of carry the burden of this play to show both its power and in some ways its weaknesses, or the weaknesses of the 1916 production. And they created an incredibly beautiful version of the play that, as a teacher, was inspiring. It was another moment where I feel like I feel this regularly. I learned more from my students than they learned from me.
So, and I'll mention, we'll come back to this theme, actually, of your students and how amazing they are. We're going to talk about that in a moment when we get to the pedagogical intermission, which was epic. But I'll also mention for listeners at this point, oh, and there's O Canada. Moment for Oh Canada. Here we go. Pause. What happens when you're podcasting at noon in Vancouver? A moment for nationalism. Now we'll move on. I'll also mention for listeners that there's a really wonderful way that the book transcends its bindings insofar as there's a website that's a supplement to the book. And I'll link to this on the post so that listeners can look at the podcast post and click there. But it includes several clips of performances and images from the plays and performances that you talk about. And in chapter two, there are links to several clips of yourself performing a number of note techniques from Hagoromo specifically. So I just want to mark that for listeners because it's a really wonderful resource. And it really kind of, again, makes the book come alive in a wonderful way.
Can I mention one other thing about the website?
Yeah.
There are also a series, one of the pages links to a series of exercises or pedagogical tools. So if you're interested in teaching no or movement, there's a lesson about teaching Pisan cantos. I was trying to think of various kinds of lessons that would work for different kinds of classes. And so in that section, there's, are you teaching graduate students? Are you teaching world modernism? Are you teaching an undergraduate class but would like to give them an experience of movement? Are you teaching dance history but would like to insert Ito Michio, who's largely been lost from dance history? So there are lots of different lesson plans basically laid out there. And I would love for them to be useful to other teachers.
Thank you. And speaking of Ito Michio, there's a whole lot that we can talk about in chapter three. This is a chapter that continues the story of At the Hawk's Well by looking at his career staging versions of the play along with other performance pieces. Just in the interest of time, we won't have time to go into this in any detail, but he's a fascinating character. He's eventually jailed in the U.S. as an enemy spy shortly after the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. And the whole chapter just traces this super fascinating career. Now, one of the really interesting things that the chapter does is it uses his career and his efforts, among other things, to stage versions of At the Hawk's Well as a case study to, in the words of the book, trouble our pieties about bad Orientalism and good multiculturalism. Since that's a really significant point that the book keeps coming back to, could you speak a little bit to that, Carrie?
Sure. I think those pieties about bad Orientalism, bad cultural appropriation, and the flip side, good multiculturalism, good diversity, were part of what has kept Ito out of dance history. And so that's one reason why I want to use his career to trouble those pieties. Ito was very active in promoting his own career with many, many Orientalist stereotypes. And I think that once again embarrasses critics to some extent. We would like him to have promoted versions of diversity, and we would like dance history to show that the very early interest many dancers had in other cultures and other ways of dancing, and the ways that particularly modern dancers in the early 20th century used other cultures to promote their creativity and to undermine traditional forms of dance. We would like that to all fit a comfortable narrative of sort of gradually working towards more multiculturalism and more sophisticated understandings of diversity, more satisfying ethical relationships with otherness. And Ito troubles the narrative that we would like to have about that material and that history, because he so actively Orientalized himself. He promoted his career with Orientalist stereotypes. He actively borrowed not only from versions of Japanese dance, but from other cultural forms. One of his famous pieces was called The Tango, and it has nothing to do with the tango as an actual dance form, but called itself tango. So he's a really complicated figure, and he was forgotten from modern dance history, in part because I think of this critical tendency to find him embarrassing. But then, as you mentioned, he was arrested, interned two days after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and eventually repatriated to Japan. And so that was part of the reason he was forgotten. And then the reasons that he was reintroduced to dance history, that he started to be reintroduced to dance history, are also very complicated. It would be very convenient if dance history could find someone not a white European or American to show the diversity present in dance. So he seems to fit that bill. And yet, as I argue in the chapter, he's actually much more complicated than that. He doesn't tell a nice, even story about multiculturalism. So I want to use my account of his story to really trouble some of those pieties and show that, for one thing, we can't kind of hold figures to the versions of multiculturalism and diversity that feel comfortable to us, but we can also understand them and use them to trouble our own sense that we've sort of got it right now. We're still very much struggling with the same issues surrounding diversity that were present in the early 20th century. We haven't come so far, and I think a figure like Ito can really show us that.
Now we move from here to a pedagogical intermission. This is chapter 4 that offers readers a lesson plan, really actively. It's really great. Based on your experience teaching Brecht's revisions on some of his no-inspired learning plays. Okay, we could, again, talk for an hour just about this chapter. It is fascinating. We won't have time to, but it's your experience and your accounts of your experience having done this in a graduate seminar, I think, in 2014. This is so helpful to read about. And the student project by Paul J. Edwards that you describe at the end is completely epic. I mean, drop the mic. just amazing. We could talk about this endlessly, but what I'll do is just mark this for listeners and ask you to talk about something that comes up in this pedagogical intermission, and that also comes up throughout the book. So I think it's important for us to at least mark it in conversation, and that is the significance of you just talked about the challenges or the problems, perhaps, of assuming we're getting things right. Here you talk about the significance of getting things wrong. Now, the book repeatedly comes back to the significance of failure as a theme. And this comes up here in this pedagogical intermission in a particularly interesting way. But Carrie, would you speak to that for us? Your feelings about the significance of failure as it animates what's happening in the book.
Sure. And I have to say that I was so concerned that the pedagogical intermission would be a terrible failure in the book.
Oh my gosh, not at all.
I'm so glad. I was afraid that readers would find it infuriating. And in fact, I wanted readers to find it infuriating at certain points, but to push on and to continue reading nonetheless, because it's really... it's an account of a kind of trick I played on my graduate students, and I wanted to try to work that trick into the pedagogical intermission so that it was working on readers. But there are so many ways that could fail. So I guess the trick is I asked students to answer some really horrific questions in a free writing exercise that was supposed to help teach them that, in fact, the free writing exercise was anything but free. It had its own conventions, you know, this 3-minute free writing exercise in response to a question. I was hoping to use this kind of exercise to help them better understand what, as you mentioned, what I consider some of Bertolt Brecht's great failed works, to understand why they failed, by understanding the way that convention and submission are part of our lives when we don't really recognize them, the way that they are submitting as students in the classroom, submitting to a terrible free writing exercise, for example, and dutifully writing their little paragraphs with, again, their conventional arguments that I was asking for. I wanted all of that to help get them to a different perspective on Bertolt Brecht's revisions of plays that are usually translated as the yes-sayer, no-sayer, that were sort of failed versions of a no play, Tanico, the Valley Hurling, that he had hoped would teach the value of submission to a socialist revolution, but actually were celebrated by the Nazi party and oddly by Catholics as teaching a kind of submission to the Nazi cause or submission to religious learning. This was not, of course, Brecht's intention, and he tried to revise the plays to make them work, but to work in the way that he wanted them to. But only the first version of the play received a score by the composer Kurt Weill, and that version was the play that was done over and over again and did have some function in the teaching of the Hitler Youth. So I wanted the students, by recognizing their own kind of submission to pedagogical methods, to understand both Brecht's failure in the play and the really difficult to teach lesson of the original no play that Brecht was using, which is a student agrees to be thrown off the mountainside because he becomes sick on a journey with his teacher, and there is a great custom that if you become sick, you've defiled a sacred journey and must be thrown off the mountain. So this is a pretty hard lesson for American students to even take seriously. And I was trying to develop a pedagogical exercise that would help them understand what that lesson could mean in different cultural contexts and how, in fact, they submit regularly to what a teacher says or demands. So in writing the pedagogical intermission, I tell the story of using this lesson plan in my graduate class. And then, as you alluded to at the end, once again, my students taught me more than I ever teach them. Paul Edwards, a remarkable student, used this whole experience in his own project, in his own performance, in which he really kind of used my strategy and cast me in his production in a way that analyzed the whole experience of being a graduate student and the kind of strange rituals that are part of academic life, from giving up meals in favor of espresso to receiving diplomas written in dead languages. It was really a fantastic presentation.
And if I'm remembering correctly, a Charlie Brown Christmas actually makes an appearance in there, yeah?
Absolutely. The very, very sad song. Yes.
Epic. So kudos mm-hmm. to you, Paul Edwards, if you're out there listening. Thanks. It was amazing. So we are, speaking of failure, right? We have totally failed to get through the entirety of the book because everything that you've been saying has been so fascinating and there's so much to talk about. This is great. I have no apologies here because I think this was exactly what we needed to do. But I'll mention a little bit just what's happening in some of the later chapters for listeners, and then ask you to just kind of talk a little bit about one of the points to bring us to a close. So chapter five looks at how modernist Noh inspired scholarship and performance in Japan. It's super interesting. And for listeners who are particularly interested in film and cinema, this might be especially engaging. This is a chapter that looks really closely at the way that the films of Ozu adapted so-called traditional performance to modernist cinema. And it pays special attention to a story of floating weeds and looks at camera angles there, and also to Late Spring, the first one from 1934, the second one from 1949. This chapter also returns us to the theme of translation being an opportunity to think about misrecognition, error, and failure as opportunities for creativity. And that brings us to the final chapter, chapter six. This is super interesting. We're not going to have time to really talk much about it, but it looks at the collaboration between Benjamin Britten and William Plomer in Curlew River. I'm going to New Jersey-ify everything that I say. So there's so much going on. It's super interesting. And you talk about this as a Noh-derived church parable that also involves elements of gender drag, of cultural appropriation. And you talk about it in terms of queerly Christian submission. So I just want to leave that there for listeners who are particularly interested in these sorts of issues. There's a whole chapter, and it's amazing. Now, the chapter also, and this is where I kind of want to ask you my final question before we move to our close, the chapter also considers Samuel Beckett's Footfalls. There's so much to talk about here. But what I want to maybe close with is something that comes from thinking about Beckett's Footfalls, the relationship between the text and Beckett and performers specifically, in generating, again, one of these larger themes that I think is a big important takeaway of the book. Here's what the book says on page 240 when talking about this, at the close of this chapter. It says, "Our myopic definitions of agency and assumptions of universal desires for a, quote, freedom that's defined in West-centric terms leads to misunderstandings of many cultural and political phenomena." And the book really closes by opening, and opening out into lots and lots of different contexts, briefly but importantly, where reorienting in the way, so to speak, in the way that you're suggesting, might be perhaps a more productive way to go about thinking with and practicing in the context of these encounters than we might otherwise be doing. So Carrie, did you want to speak a little bit to that, maybe as a way of kind of bringing this to a close?
Absolutely. Again, my encounter with Noh asked me to question so much about what I assumed. I'm very clear in the book that my sort of theoretical background is shaped by queer theory, feminist theory, and post-colonial theory. And I learned through studying Noh, through falling in love with this art form in some ways, that there were a set of assumptions that those theories shared that I think were causing me and maybe some others to misunderstand the world. So the assumption that subversion is just a standard good and something that we desire in the world, that we should be subverting cultural norms, that we should be battling conventions, that we should be looking in the literature that we study for moments of subversion, those had become critical habits for me. And Noh was not going to be a subversive theater form in most ways, or at least not conventionally subversive. And the artists in the 20th century who were responding to Noh and inspired by Noh, many of the works that they created also weren't conventionally subversive, and yet they were really interesting. And in the last chapter, that started, I account how that made me think about my own contemporary moment where it seems impossible for so many to imagine what would compel anyone to participate in a suicide bombing in the name of a god, how you could get there. And I think Noh helped me understand the ways that submitting to a divine being isn't so different from, say, a U.S. military member submitting to the notion of spreading freedom and democracy and liberty around the world and risking one's life for that kind of metaphysical concept, that really isn't so far from the idea that someone would submit and risk life for a divinity. Noh, in part, taught me to think that way by teaching me to really question assumptions that have governed my thoughts and my habits of mind, and the ways that I've taught and worked with students. So in the end, I don't want that last chapter to sort of sound conservative or in any way supportive of terrorism, suicide bombings, but I wanted to show how my study of Noh had helped me think differently about the world that I'm living in, and to recognize that freedom, liberty, subversion were not values that are held universally around the world, and that in fact they really don't entirely govern our own culture in the way that we assume they do. So I was hoping that last chapter would really open up some of those questions, not to provide answers exactly, but just to have us think differently and to think in a way that might help us accommodate and understand cultural difference.
So now that we are at the conclusion of our interview, and there's so much more that we could talk about, right? I mean, we could spend another couple hours talking easily.
And I would love to if we could.
Me too. But Carrie, in the absence of that opportunity, at least for now, is there anything in particular that didn't come up but that you'd like to mention for listeners before we close?
I suppose that the one thing that I would mention about this book is that, this did come up a little bit in my last response, but one of my great fears about the book is that it would seem retrograde and conservative as I was questioning assumptions from feminist theory and queer theory and post-colonial studies, that it would seem like I was sort of advocating a conservative approach. In fact, so much of what I was able to realize in the book came through the internal critiques of those fields and many critics that were using the tools, for example, of queer theory to subject it to a certain kind of critique. I feel like my book is very much in the spirit of that kind of work. Eve Sedgwick is a really important figure for me in that work. Saba Mahmood and Sarah Ahmed also are doing that work. And I wanted my book to be in their spirit, what Sedgwick calls reparative reading, and exploring another phrase that I love from Sedgwick, the middle ranges of agency, really looking at how black and white thinking, polarized thinking, leads us to some misunderstanding of our own lives and of the cultural materials that we explore in our work. So I suppose that's the one disclaimer. I want to make sure that no one enters into the book thinking that it's conservative or that I'm in any way rejecting the theories that have been so important to my thinking. I think of those theories of having shown me a way to try to get beyond that polarized, dichotomous thinking. And to connect once again to our cultural moment, I think that polarization, the tendency to lose the middle ranges, or in the United States, the whole middle of the country, and not communicate and not understand each other is one of the great problems we face. That's the one thing I wanted to mention.
And now that the book is out, what are you currently working on? What's inspiring you lately?
So I've started a new project about audience participation in the theater and how audience participation is used to and our attempt to teach lessons about race and gender. The book right now is provisionally called Participate, and part of it is a history of forms of participation in the theater and the ways that we kind of misunderstand immersive theater as this brand new and very important and very subversive thing, when in fact participation has been central to the theater for a long time, its entire history. But I really want to focus also on what audience participation is trying to teach us, particularly about race and gender. And some of the methodologies of my first book are really entering in. So the book tries to include my own experiences as a participant in various theatrical productions as core anecdotes for each chapter. So that's something that I learned to do in learning to kneel that I hope to also include in the new project.
Well, best of luck. Thanks for taking time.
Thank you.
To talk about this book. And it's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us today, and come back again soon.